Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be sort of spreading our wings a little bit. We're going to get extraterrestrial. We're going to be talking a little bit about planetary science. I'm sure that some of you have been seeing in the newspapers lately that we're finding exoplanets or whatever they are, the planets that look similar to Earth around our sun, but in places a long way away. And we're also, of course, really interested in our own planetary system, our own solar system. Is it really getting warmer on Mars? Does that have any particular relevance to our particular activities at home? Well, of course, you know I know nothing about the subject, and so our guest today is Dr. Andrew Ingersoll. He's a professor of planetary science at California Institute of Technology, the so-called famous Caltech. Andrew Ingersoll, Andy Ingersoll, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So before we get into planetary science and your contributions to it and your sort of fascination for planets outside of our own, tell us a little bit about how Andy Ingersoll became a scientist. What were those moments when you were a young boy and a young man that sort of led you into this career?
Well, it really started back in junior high school. I had suffered through my multiplication tables and didn't really like that part of mathematics. But then I took my first course in algebra, and there were these tricky problems about if Mary's age was twice as much as Jane's age and how, you know, they were sort of complicated, and I could work them out in my head, but the teacher explained how I could set X equal to the unknown, and then I could use that to solve for the answer. And a little light went on in my head right there, and I said, this is powerful, and it's a tool that's going to, well, it enables a person to do things that couldn't ordinarily do, or it would be much harder to do.
Yeah, there's an intuitive answer, and then there's the answer that you actually have tools to get to.
Yeah, I felt it was powerful, and I didn't quite know what I would do with this power. But then along a few years later, I was in a high school physics class, and I could use X and all these symbols to actually solve how the ball would roll down the plane or how the bullet right. would fly through the air. And I said, oh, this is powerful. It's a power to understand the natural world.
Right. And you could also answer the Mensa quizzes in American Airlines, you know, booklets when you get on the airplane, right?
I didn't do that, but I suppose I could have.
Absolutely. So then you were particularly interested in the use of algebra and mathematics in physics. Did you get a degree in physics, or did you... How did it proceed when you went to college?
Well, I was kind of a undefined physicist, and I guess my favorite subject was things I could grab hold of and imagine on Earth-like or human scale. Particles were too remote, and exploding galaxies was too remote.
Right.
Something in between was about all I knew at that point, but I was fortunate that one of my professors brought me along one summer to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts on a piece of land sticking out into the Atlantic Ocean. And I realized that this was physics, but it was physics of the natural world, and it just matched my particular interests. And so I went into geophysics and took it from there.
So this is the sort of physics where you take off little explosions, not exploding galaxies, but little detonations, and watch the sound waves permeate through the world or through the surface, and then you can learn things about the underground world. Is that more or less what you were doing?
Well, you learn about, at Woods Hole, we learned about how the oceans work and the currents that flow in the ocean. There's things like the Gulf Stream and so
right.
on, and how the ocean exchanges with the atmosphere. And so it was really a chance to understand the environment, and I appreciated that.
I mean, that's true, because the ancient mariners knew all about the Gulf Stream and all the other currents around the world. But here you are, you know, beginning to apply the science of physics to it so that we've got a much superior understanding. And then that appealed to you.
Very definitely. And I also went out on the original ship of the Woods Hole Oceanographic, the Atlantis. And so I had a one-month cruise on the Atlantis, and that was great fun.
What time of the year was that?
It was August.
Okay, right.
Yeah, very pleasant.
Makes a difference, right?
Oh, yeah.
I remember my family immigrated with me from England. They came by, I flew, and they came by boat. But they came in a pretty bad time of the year. And when I picked them up eventually at New Orleans, they were all smiles and sunburned because they'd had about 4 days sort of coming through the nicer part of the journey. But they never forgot to tell me about the first 10 days. It was pretty murderous. Anyway, so you're on the these voyages of discovery, if you like, using physics, et cetera. Where did you go from there? Then did you carry on with this geophysics area, or did you decide to move into something a little larger?
Well, okay, so you got me into college, and I decided I liked oceanography, but at the same time, I was learning meteorology, and by graduate school, I was definitely in a department of oceanography and meteorology. Then I got a PhD. This is Harvard, and choice, where do I go from there? And I suppose I could have been a weather forecaster, but in fact, that seemed kind of boring because it was a daily obligation.
And it's a repetition. I mean, in England, it was always cloudy with possible sunshine and showers. In West Texas, it's just that a front is coming through and it'll be windy and then it'll be back up to 90. You know, I wonder why they spend 5 minutes every night on TV stations repeating what they repeated last week.
That's really unfair to meteorologists, because what they do behind the scenes is to improve their weather forecast, and that's really challenging work. And
but what we need them to improve the weather, but that's a totally separate issue.
Well, that's a problem with England, maybe.
Anyway, so then you decided on...
So I could have been a meteorologist, but I really was attracted to things that we knew less about. We knew a lot about the Earth's weather. There was certainly room for improvement in the forecasting, but the deep oceans were kind of terra incognita. And the other place where there's atmospheres and weather are the other planets. And so the timing was right. This was now in the late 60s, where the space program was just booming, or starting up to boom. And there was really a lot of ignorance and a lot of chance to cure the ignorance and make discoveries. So I went into planetary science.
Well, now, how did you get into, because there was no planetary science course, I suspect, anyway, certainly no major programs. So this was a learn-as-you-went business, and there was a small group of you, pioneers in the area?
Well, there, for one thing, Caltech offered me a job.
Okay.
That's always good. And they said, come and teach us about the weather on other planets. And that was just fine with me. At the same time, NASA was beginning to send space probes to the planets. And in fact, we had sort of a peaceful race going on with the Soviets. And maybe it was all symbolic of our missile capability, but it was still a peaceful race to who could make the discoveries first. And it was an exciting time starting in the late 60s. And
so you just couldn't turn up to your classes in Caltech and talk about the weather like an abstract, because there were experiments going on. You had to sort of shape what you were teaching to what you now knew as the experimental.
Right. And in fact, what made it exciting was that we knew so little, and we were learning a lot very fast, and people would throw out theories about what was going on, and then the theory would be tested in a rather short amount of time, a few years. And, of course, a lot of theories fail, but some of them survive, and of course, you want your theory to survive, and And even if it's someone else's theory, it's an exciting time to be part of that.
So obviously you started with the what we'll call the solar planets, that is our own solar system, and then presumably as we get later into this program, we can talk further and further afield, you know, light years afield. But when you started this project, you know, with your Soviet colleagues, did you decide to sort of split the solar system into parts? I know geochemists, and for example, or geologists, who split Greenland into multiple little sections, 3 acres here and 3 acres, and they each specify and concentrate their efforts into this 1 3-acre area. Did you sort of divide the solar system up a little bit, or go wherever you wanted?
No, I didn't respect any boundaries.
All right.
You know, some of my early work, I was an opportunist. If there was a spacecraft with the promise of new data, I got involved. And so I was involved with early missions to Jupiter and Saturn. Then I was involved with Mars and Venus. So each one of those planets has a substantial atmosphere and lots of weather and climate to study, but the challenges in each case and the questions are very different.
Well, let's start with your very first. Was Jupiter the very first chance that you got to study the weather there? What amazed you that was different to the weather patterns and the concepts on Jupiter than what we already knew on Earth?
Well, the first thing was that Jupiter has storms like the Great Red Spot that has been around ever since, well, at least since the telescope was invented. In other words, back in the 17th century, the telescope had improved to the point that you could see features in the clouds on Jupiter, and one of them, at least, was big enough so that people gave it a name, the Great Red Spot, and that has stuck, and that thing is still there after 300 years, and it's just a storm. It's not a piece of solid land. There's no continents floating on Jupiter.
Right.
Jupiter is just a big ball of gas with colored clouds. And somehow this thing has held itself together. And that's completely unlike the storms on Earth.
I mean, that particular feature, the red spot, it changes in size quite dramatically?
Not really. It rolls like a ball bearing, a very big ball bearing. It's bigger than two or three Earths. It's about two or three Earths in size. But it rolls between two currents on either side of it. But the spot itself, it's shrunk over the decades, but it's pretty constant.
And so that was your first sort of exposure to really remarkable things out there in space.
We collected data from it, and we also built computer simulations of the Great Red Spot. And I thought it was going to be some kind of very special conditions that allowed storms to last for hundreds of years. But then when we started building computer simulations, it turned out that you could slap something together, and as long as it was faithful to the laws of fluid mechanics, you'd get a permanent vortex that just sat there. And, of course, since we had a simulation on a computer, we could do great things. We could produce two red spots and send them at
right.
each other, let them collide. One eats up the other one.
Oh, that's it's just like atomic physics, right?
Yeah.
Banging one nucleus against another, and all sorts of interesting things happen.
Yeah, see, normally in environmental science, oceanography, meteorology, you don't get to do experiments. You just watch.
Right.
You watch what happens, but you don't control it. But if you have a computer simulation, you can actually do experiments and test it.
And then test it in the future.
And then compare what you're getting with what you see out in the real world or that world out there. If it is faithful, you say, well, pretty good simulation.
And we know something. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest this week is Professor Andy Ingersoll from Caltech Planetary Science, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Let's start with a quiz. What do the water flea, the marbled crayfish, and the boa constrictor have in common?
No, they're not merely the nicknames of your daughter's high school boyfriends.
All these animals can produce offspring without a fertilized egg. This asexual reproduction called parthenogenesis comes from the Greek, meaning virgin birth.
We're discovering that more species are capable of this than we ever knew. Nearly all reproduction requires the union of a sperm and an egg. But in parthenogenesis, only the female chromosomes are involved, producing, in most cases, identical clones of the mother.
Species that strictly reproduce this way, such as the New Mexico whiptail lizard, risk genetic mutations in the long run without a diverse gene pool.
But one species found a clever way to mix up its genes by incorporating DNA from its environment. For over 40 million years, the microscopic Deloid rotifers produced asexually by ingesting DNA present in their freshwater pools.
Over the past decade, scientists discovered quite by accident that several animals they kept in captivity were capable of asexual reproduction. Two female Komodo dragons kept separate from males produced healthy clones, even though in the wild they reproduced sexually. A hammerhead shark and a boa constrictor, both in captivity, also produced clones.
We don't know what triggered these species to begin non-sexual reproduction, and we haven't seen it yet in mammals. But understanding this process may one day help save endangered species.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Dr. Andrew Ingersoll from Caltech, talking about his interest in weather on different planets. Okay, so you started with Jupiter. What's your favorite planet and why?
Well,
don't say Pluto.
The ancient Greeks, the goddesses asked that same question of Paris, and he got into a lot of trouble for the answer. So I have five children, and they ask me, who's your favorite child? I don't answer questions like that.
Okay. I have five children, and I understand.
Listen, I'll name three of them, like the three goddesses, Jupiter, Mars, and Venus. They're all fascinating places to study.
Okay, so you looked at the red spot on Jupiter. You put together in the age of the computers coming in, great modeling to predict things. Have you been able, for example, to say, well, we did this modeling based upon something we observed here, and in fact we saw that phenomenon, but somewhere totally different? Has that ever occurred? That you've seen somewhere else two red spots coming together? Not that that's the precise example that I want, but have you been able to make a prediction and then find something?
Definitely yes, because the red spot is not the only long-lived vortex on Jupiter. There's really hundreds of smaller spots, and we can watch them and compare their behavior to the simulations. And
all on Jupiter.
All on Jupiter,
so it's a
but
spotty
also
planet,
on,
right?
On the other giant planets, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. There's differences between them, and in fact, even in the oceans of Earth, there are these spinning vortices or vortex. They're also called rings and eddies in the ocean, but they merge with each other, and that is one of the properties that we were seeing on Jupiter and in our simulations, is spots merging with each other, spots orbiting around each other, and all that is seen in nature and also in the simulation.
Well, that's very interesting, because it seems to me, if I'm interpreting what you said correctly, that your studies of weather patterns, or what we call weather, on the planets have in fact permitted us to understand something about our own planetary weather. That would be a correct conclusion then.
I wouldn't use the word permitted. Right. I think permitted is too strong a word. I think seeing the weather on other planets gives you a deeper understanding of weather in general, but I wouldn't say we needed to go to the planets, or it was necessary to go to the planets to finally understand weather on Earth or the Earth's oceans. I'd say it gives you a kind of broader perspective, and it unleashes your imagination a little more.
Okay. I mean, for example, we have the trade winds here, we have the doldrums. Are those sorts of concepts interpretable onto the planets. I mean, they all circulate. They've all got equators. So the same patterns of trade winds and doldrums, you know, in the middle where there's not too much wind. Would that be true to say that the weather patterns on the other planets parallel that of Earth?
Yes, they parallel a lot of the features, and we study them as common phenomena, but really the differences between different planets are more important because it tells us what factors control. Like, for instance, everyone's worried about, as the Earth gets warmer due to human activities, are the deserts going to expand into higher latitudes? Will the doldrums expand or shrink? And, you know, will we have droughts where we presently have plenty of rainfall? And so questions like that, you can run your computer models, but it's nice to see a variety of other planets which have kind of their tropics and subtropical zones that we can compare with Earth. And some of those tropical and subtropical zones are rather different from our Earth, even though they're present.
Well, let's move on to that for a little, Andy, because, you know, currently climate change, the role of CO2, it's a big issue. I think sort of the average daily concentration of CO2 around the world just exceeded 400, and that means certain things are predicted to happen. And then there are people who say, okay, well, that's fine, but, you know, do we really understand enough about the weather patterns and the implication of CO2 on climate change? What do we know about other planets? And then someone says, you know, the doubting Thomas says, well, but, you know, this warming is going on in Mars, and therefore, if we don't understand Mars, how can we understand the Earth, and therefore, da-da-da. Could you address that as a sort of an intellectual and scientific problem for us?
Well, there's not much evidence that Mars is warming up. The weather is constantly changing on all planets, and there's cycles, and there are long-term trends. But we don't have enough data to say Mars is warming up. A more scary planet is Venus, if you want a good example. Venus is a hellish place. On the surface of Venus, it's hot enough to melt lead. It's hotter than your oven in a household oven. And this is all because of the massive carbon dioxide atmosphere. And the water has boiled away and chemically been destroyed by the sun, and yet there is evidence that Venus was much more Earth-like in the past. So,
Hang on, let me interject there.
Yeah,
how does one find that evidence? What is that evidence, and how on Earth was one finding it out?
It's tricky. There is water on Venus. It's all in the atmosphere. There's no liquid water. It's too hot for that. It's no ice. Much too hot for ice. But there is a little bit of liquid water in the atmosphere, and the hydrogen in that water, in all water, there's the heavy hydrogen called deuterium, and there's the light hydrogen, which is just ordinary hydrogen. And on just about all the objects in the solar system, there's a ratio of the amount of the heavy to the light, and it's pretty constant within a factor of two. And Venus, the heavy hydrogen is 150 times more abundant than it is on Earth relative to the ordinary hydrogen.
Wow.
And so this is a sign that hydrogen, because hydrogen resides in water, that hydrogen has been lost. And the lighter stuff, we know that the lighter stuff floats off into space faster than the heavy stuff. So if you go to a planet and find that it's enriched in the heavy stuff, you can infer that, well, there's been a lot of water depletion over the history.
Yeah, so it's really...
It's chemical evidence.
Yeah, and it's an impoverishment, if you like, of the regular hydrogen, not a concentration of the, or an extra amount of the deuterium.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We can't quite... I mean, 150 is a really big difference between the rest of the solar system. But we can't quite say how much water was lost, but it could easily be an ocean's worth.
And relate that, if you would, because you brought it up at the beginning, you know, this phenomenal amount of CO2 in the atmosphere of Venus. go through the sort of the scientific scenario as how those two features are related?
There's actually a lot of CO2 on Earth, but it's all in the carbonate shells and calcium carbonate, limestone deposits. And in fact, the difference really is that Earth has always been cold enough to have oceans. And once you have liquid water, the liquid water draws down the carbon dioxide and deposits it as limestone. And so because we're far enough from the sun, we don't have a massive CO2 atmosphere. Instead, we have limestone. But Venus was close enough to the sun so that the CO2 was always in the atmosphere, and that kept it very warm, and that caused the oceans to eventually be destroyed and the hydrogen to escape and the oxygen to combine with the rocks and become a mineral.
Let's sort of just go on to the final point, in a sense, that here you are an eminent scientist who's basically spent a career studying climatology on Earth to begin with, and then climatology on the various planets in the solar system. What's your current take on the condition of the Earth's climate? How worried should we all be?
Oh, I think global warming, due to the buildup of greenhouse gases, is going to happen. I think it's silly to deny it. On the other hand, the consequences to human beings are harder to predict. My job is not politics or economics, and I don't think anyone has very good predictions about what the economy is going to be like. So I think it's silly to deny global warming. It's going to happen. What is hard to do is to sort out how bad it's going to be. It's probably going to be very bad for poor agricultural societies, and probably the powerful countries will get by with using their power. So I think the uncertainty is all human affairs.
But let's be more specific, because in a sense, scientists have this tremendous power of experiment, of computer modeling, and we understand things, and yet we've got to translate that understanding for people like yourself into some form of policy. So you say you're not an economist, et cetera, and clearly that's understood. But we cannot surely leave decisions to politicians without making the scientific evidence extremely clear, potent, and unambiguous.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, the scientific evidence is getting lost in the politics. And really, the scientific evidence is fairly clear that it's getting warmer, and it will get warmer. So I think, as a specialist in atmospheric science, that my job is to keep showing that evidence.
We'd like to have you back again, Andy, because we haven't even touched upon all these planets that are light years away that people are beginning to see.
No, and we haven't talked about Mars and the possibility of life on Mars, and a lot of good stuff out there.
Well, do you want to come back next week?
Sure.
Okay, good. Andy Ingersoll, Professor of Planetary Science, Caltech. Thank you so much for being with us, and we do indeed look forward to you next week.
You're welcome.
So I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for putting this together again, and that beautiful smile on the other side of the window. And as you heard just now, we will be back next week with another Science Studio. You make sure you're there too. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center at El Paso has officially become the fourth university of the Texas Tech system as of May 20th. The El Paso campus now goes from being a branch of Texas Tech Lubbock to having its own president. This development is expected to improve access to medical care and expand research in the region. Read more at the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.